had to be the smoothest, most bland area you could find, preferably near the lunar center.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. On this episode, we're listening back to some of our favorite stories from 2019. 2019 was the 150th anniversary of professional baseball, dating back to the launch of the Cincinnati Red Stockings in 1869. Vintage baseball teams across the U.S. like to celebrate the game as it was played in its formative years. Our Jesse King caught a doubleheader between the Fleischmann's Mountain Athletic Club and the Brooklyn Atlantics.
We're going to get started, folks. Be aware of all about you guys are all in play right here, so we'll try to be careful about, you know, being around you, but be alive. This is a live game.
Mountain Athletic Club Captain Colin Miller directs fans via megaphone as they park folding chairs along the edge of a field. The original Mountain Athletic Club, or MAC, was founded in 1895 in Griffin's Corners, New York, but today's edition is in Grahamsville in Sullivan County. Aside from the bases, a pitcher's box, and a makeshift hay backstop, the field is bare. Miller, a professional forester, introduces himself as Stumpy before the bat toss, while his competitor, English teacher and Atlantics captain Frank Van Zant, goes by Shakespeare.
You just have to be very careful not to do something extremely stupid on the field, because that's what your nickname's going to be based on. We had a fellow named Crawler on his first day on the field. He crawled to second base, and he was kind of a night crawler also, so It was apt, but it was kind of based on a stupid thing that he did on the field.
Van Zant says the original Atlantic Baseball Club was founded in 1855. Back then, baseball wasn't yet a compound word, and the Atlantic's Don White shirts have ABBC stitched across the front. They play by the rules of 1864, one of 2 years the Atlantics went undefeated as national champions. Van Zant says, depending on who you ask, the club was a precursor to the Brooklyn Dodgers and missed a chance to become one of the first professional teams in 1871.
Professionalism was very controversial, the same way that professionalism is controversial for college athletes today. Should we pay them? Should we not pay them? A year later, they tried to recoup that, and they did become professional, but they didn't have the players to justify it, and they were a very poor professional team for a period of time until they sort of fell out of practice.
Today, the Atlantics are in full form for Game 1. By 1864 rules, all pitches or hurls are underhand, and the batter or striker is out if the ball is caught on the fly or on the first bounce. That could be because there are no gloves. Players catch the ball with their bare hands, sometimes at their peril. Daisy cutters, now known as grounders, are common. Fouls don't count as strikes, and three balls make a walk. Umpire Jeff Fry stands to the side of the striker, dressed in a shirt vest and a top hat, while calling pitches as he pleases.
When I feel the pitcher is throwing too many balls, I give a warning to the pitcher that lets him know anything he throws that I feel is a ball. After that, I'm going to call a ball. Same thing with the batter. If the pitcher's throwing strikes, the batter's just standing there, I give a warning to the striker, which means any pitch that comes in after that that I feel is a strike, I'm going to call a strike.
Fire him in there. She's recording.
Van Zant says hurlers no longer had to throw underhand in the 1880s, and clubs like the Providence Grays made overhand pitching the norm. The Max Archie Byruk says fielders were wearing gloves by 1895, although they had little padding and no webbing. Byruk's been playing vintage baseball for about 20 years, goes by Lumberman with his teammates, and usually makes a new bat before each game at his sawmill.
For the era we play today, we're only allowed 2.5-inch barrel. It's got to be over an inch on the handle. And then the second game we played, you can go up to 2.75, still no less than an inch. It can be 42 inches long, which nobody could ever swing.
Hits are louder in Game 2, which uses the Max 1895 rules and a livelier ball. Catches on the first bounce no longer result in outs, but foul balls hit off a bunt or caught by the catcher are strikes. Atlantic's co-captain Dean Emma, a.k.a. Dream Bucket, explains the Red Stockings won 81 straight games when they first started paying stars, before, he notes, falling to the Atlantics 8-7 in an 11-inning game in 1870.
The finest game ever played. That was how it was written by the journalists.
Tag. Go, it's bouncing, go!
Yeah, so before 1869, they were getting paid underneath the table. And, gamblers would be like, I'll give you $100 if you guys beat this team. That was pretty well known.
As Van Zant explained, the Atlantics initially passed on professionalism, but the MAC became a semi-pro team. Miller says owners Julius and Max Fleischmans eventually got involved with the Cincinnati Reds and used the MAC as a spring training for Reds players. Miller says the MAC bankrolled five of the Chicago White Sox hitless wonders in 1906, as well as Hall of Famers Honus Wagner and Miller Huggins.
Miller Huggins actually played under the name Proctor. At the time, he was an NCAA athlete, and he was afraid he would lose his scholarship money if he got paid to play by the Fleischmans, so he played under the name Proctor.
The MAC continued in Griffin's Corners until 1913, when the village changed its name to Fleischmans. Now, today is a golden era to be a baseball fan. You can watch games in HD on your smartphone and follow box scores in real time, with Major League Baseball now a billion-dollar industry. So why play vintage baseball? Van Zandt says there are hundreds of teams across the country, and the Atlantics play over 40 games a season. Fan Vivian Ginsburg says she wouldn't miss it.
They're like baseball reenactors.
Whoa, heads up! Save that ball. It's a $12 ball.
Players like Van Zandt and Miller say it's about keeping baseball history alive. Like their original counterparts, today's vintage baseball teams get people outside and having fun.
It's very hard to get a sore attitude when you're on the field. It's really enjoyable.
Yeah, I liken it to sort of like a baseball subculture. I would say a fraternity, but we actually have co-ed.
Three cheers for the Atlantics! Hip hip, hurrah! Hip hip, hurrah!
The Atlantics are one of the MAC's toughest outs. By the end of this day, the ABBC have swept the bill, taking Game 1 16-9 and Game 2 20-7 in 7 innings. The Mountain Athletic Club still calls its original park in Fleischmann's home. The Brooklyn Atlantics play their home games on Long Island at the Smithtown Historical Society. All you need to attend is a temporary trip back in time. Reporting from Grahamsville, I'm Jesse King.
Back on September 11th, most of the country remembered the attack on the U.S. 18 years ago. Memorials were also held in New York's North Country to commemorate the first attack on the U.S. in 1814. During the Battle of Plattsburgh, the British fought Americans for control of Lake Champlain. More than 100 British and American soldiers are buried in unmarked graves on an unpopulated island that served as a field hospital. Every year on September 11th, the American Legion and others gather at the memorial to lay a wreath and pay tribute. WAMC's North Country Bureau Chief Pat Bradley reports.
Crab Island is accessible only by boat. Most of the 40-acre limestone island is flush with scrub and poison ivy, but trails lead to a 100-foot-tall flagpole. Farther along the paths stands a stone obelisk. Both are dedicated to British, Canadian, and American soldiers who died during the 1814 Battle of Plattsburgh and are buried somewhere on the island. Wednesday's wreath-laying ceremony began at the flagpole.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're here to lay a wreath in honor of our veterans from the Battle of Valcour and the Battle of Plattsburgh, who gave the ultimate sacrifice on October 11, 1776, and on 9-11, 1814. We're going to lay a wreath in their honor and raise the flag.
Detail, port arms, prepare to fire, aim, fire!
Okay, we'll proceed down to the monument now, where we'll lay a wreath in front of the graves.
The group then hikes about 10 minutes to the obelisk for another tribute.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to lay a wreath here in honor of our vets who made the ultimate sacrifice, and also for our veterans on Valcour Island.
Detail, prepare to fire, aim, fire! Port arms, present arms!
Sons of the American Legion member John Rock is also an active member of the Friends of Crab Island.
There was a battle took place here on September 11, 1814, when Commodore McDonough, who held off the British with a small fleet and sent the British back home. And on this island, there was a military hospital headed by Dr. James Mann, an Army surgeon. And the casualties and wounded from the ships, they brought him onto the island. And he treated the ones that he could and saved the ones that he could. And, of course, some of them perished. And as they perished, this became a burial site. There are 50 American vets buried under this island. And they have been out here for now 205 years. And until we put their names up in 2002, their names have never been displayed, and they gave the ultimate sacrifice.
Rock adds that their tribute is unique because they include Canadian and British soldiers from the opposing side who are also buried on the island.
Because as the British fleet came down through Canada, they did not have enough people on their ships to man their ships, so they stopped and took people at gunpoint and said, you are now a member of the British Navy. So we don't know exactly how many are out here, but we do know there are Canadians out here. There are 50 Americans as far as we know, and there's 102 British and Canadians that are buried on the island.
Plattsburgh supervisor Michael Cashman, who laid the wreaths during the two ceremonies, says Crab Island is a hub in the town's Battlefield Memorial Gateway project.
Crab Island represents the Battle of Plattsburgh. Just a little ways away is the northern tip of Valcour Island, which represents the American Revolution. And then, of course, when it stitches back to the land side where the gateway is, that's referred to as the Triangle of History. And on Lake Champlain, there have been some of the most pivotal battles that ever occurred in the American story right here.
The Battle of Plattsburgh occurred on September 11th, 1814. The American naval victory is credited with leading to the Treaty of Ghent that formally ended the War of 1812. I'm Pat Bradley, WAMC News.
Leon Theremin's strange electronic musical instrument that lent its otherworldly sound to cheesy horror movie soundtracks and was emulated on the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations is marking its 100th birthday. To celebrate, the Albany Symphony performed a work that showcases the theremin. WAMC's Lucas Willard reports.
Warming up before rehearsal at the Palace Theater, Carolina Ike is playing a theremin. She's waving her hands around what appears to be a wooden box on legs with an antenna sticking out of either side, one upright, the other a closed loop. Ike, who grew up in Germany, has been playing the theremin since she was 7.
The notes are anywhere, right? So you can just move your hand and there is a sound.
Ike has developed an 8-finger position technique for coaxing notes out of space. A virtuoso of the invisible, it looks like she's playing keys.
And now I can play a scale by slowly and gradually opening my hand.
The theremin can sound like a human voice, a violin, or something else.
Because we can get really low bass out of the instrument, right? So the range is almost endless.
On Saturday, Ike will join the Albany Symphony in performing a work written by composer Dalit Warshaw. Like Ike, Warshaw also discovered the theremin at an early age. In the 1980s, she learned from Clara Rockmore, the artistic muse of the instrument's inventor and namesake.
I resolved to, as a composer, add to the repertoire of this instrument, but showing it, revealing it as a concert instrument, one that can convey intense humanity and soul and a romantic musicality.
Warshaw's piece is called Sirens, Concerto for Theremin and Orchestra. There are 3 movements, and she says each addresses a different idea of what the word sirens implies.
The first movement is called Clara's Violin, which tells Clara Rockmore's own life story, starting out as a violinist, meeting the inventor, theremin, and playing in duet with her sister, Nadia Reisenberg, who was a pianist. The second movement is entitled Ulysses, and it addresses Kafka's version of the siren's story from Homer's Odyssey. And Kafka maintained that even more devastatingly seductive than the song of the sirens itself was when they stopped singing. It was the silence. The third movement is called Flugelhorn, and it addresses the alarm definition of siren. It's comical. The theremin glissando is all over the place, and in the middle, the orchestra itself becomes a theremin.
Sirens will be performed alongside works by Russian masters, Borodin's Prince Igor Overture and Rachmaninoff's Symphony No. 2. Music director and conductor David Alan Miller says the Albany Symphony strives to do something unusual and exciting with each concert.
I always think it's kind of like food. It's, you know, you don't want to eat meat and potatoes every night. And sometimes you want to go really crazy and have really exotic, unusual, new tastes. And
with its Albany debut, Sirens Concerto for Theremin and Orchestra also has some local significance. Westinghouse in Springfield, Massachusetts, and General Electric in nearby Schenectady decades ago were subcontracted by RCA to manufacture the original theremins.
If there needed to be another ideal reason for this concerto to be done by the Albany Symphony, I can't think of a better one.
The Albany Symphony Orchestra's Saturday program begins at 7:30. To see Ike playing and more information, visit WAMC.org. For WAMC News, I'm Southern Adirondack Bureau Chief Lucas Willard.
A local conservation group is teaming up with federal scientists to learn more about the effects of industrial water flow manipulations on the fish of western Massachusetts. WAMC's Berkshire Bureau Chief Josh Landes reports.
On the banks of the Deerfield River in Roe, Massachusetts, a group of scientists are crowded around a basin filled with water and bookended by a pair of metal plates attached to a machine. In that basin lies a fish about to receive a shock. Well, the first in a series of shocks.
There's some discussion and debate in the scientific community as to whether they're in fact anesthetized and whether they're conscious while this is happening or not. They call it electroanesthesia. So it's a form of non-chemical anesthesia that allows us to do a surgery on the fish without having the fish react the way it normally would to getting a knife stuck in its gut.
When the trout comes to, it will be part of something much larger than itself. Ted Castro Santos is a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Silvio Conti Anadromous Fish Research Center. His team and their mobile fish surgery unit is working on taking the wild trout of the Deerfield River and turning them into living transponders, offering an unprecedented look into life among the fish of western Massachusetts.
We're going to take a scalpel. I should have spoken a little more carefully, right? So this is a surgical instrument, but the fish doesn't care. But in any case, we're going to use that to make an incision into the abdominal wall. We will then use this curved needle here, which is just a modified hypodermic needle, large gauge, that we then pierce the body cavity near that incision with that needle, and then it comes up through the opening in the incision. We then take this radio, this is a radio transmitter here, and the antenna will go through that needle, will pull that antenna back out through that hole that we use to pierce the body cavity. This goes down into the incision, and then we suture that incision back up so the tag is now inside the fish.
The undertaking is part of a public and private collaboration.
We already know that there are a large number of wild trout in this section of the area, and that they are spawning and that they are repopulating in the main stem of the Deerfield. However, we believe it could be significantly better if we get better, higher flows in the wintertime.
Kevin Parsons is the past president and current board member of the Deerfield River Watershed Chapter of Trout Unlimited.
Trout Unlimited is one of the largest conservation organizations in the United States, and our chapter's mission is for the Deerfield River watershed, which includes the Deerfield River and all of the tributaries in western Massachusetts. So it's a pretty big area. The mission of TU is to enhance and promote and protect cold water fisheries for the benefit of wild trout and salmon.
The reason the flow of the Deerfield is in question is simple. it's been monetized.
This is a very strange river, to say the least. This is a river, is a big working river, hydroelectric facilities up and down the river. There's 10 different dams, a number of different impoundments, and daily fluctuations of flow, dramatic changes in flow from a minimum flow of 125 CFS all the way up to 900 to 1,000 CFS. And that happens almost daily.
That's cubic feet per second. When companies impound water in dams on the Deerfield, it's essentially liquid money that they can convert into power for the grid when needed.
So these fish are in a constant battle of going, of dealing with up and down flows. And so that's part of the problem that's going on and that we're investigating with the United States USGS Silvio Conti Center and Mass Fish and Wildlife to assess what's going on with these fish as these hydropeaking flows are happening, and particularly the effects on their spawning, which happens in October.
Parsons says the group has already found that when the fish spawn during a high flow, the resultant eggs are then vulnerable to the elements when the water returns to a low flow. So now, as the state and federal government relicense hydroelectric companies, TU and the government scientists are hoping the experiment will establish what's at stake for the fish. While the river is partially stocked, its native population is making a comeback. And alongside conservationists and scientists, local river guides like Chris Jackson are banking on that return.
It's a beautiful, majestic river out here in the Berkshires, and it's a source of recreation, not just fly fishing, but people inner tube, people, there's rafting companies on the river. So this is really kind of a big deal out here in the Berkshires in terms of recreation.
He's one of at least a dozen guides working on the Deerfield, and says thousands of visitors come to fish in the area each season.
We're actually trying to quantify what's here in the river, and ultimately we would like to see changes made that kind of enhance the fishery. And you know, recreation is a big driver of the local economy, and our hopes is that we improve this fishery, that it'll kind of dovetail into improving the local economy.
For now, Parsons says TU just wants to marshal enough information together to convince the government that hydroelectric companies can do more to work together in considering the fish by making the changes in the river's flow less extreme.
Brookfield says, don't blame us. We just pass through what we get from Great River. Great River says, baloney. You've got pump storage. You've got all that storage up above. And if you want to ameliorate some issues as far as your hydropeaking and these higher winter flows that are being asked for, you can do that through your pump storage. And they're saying no, because we're getting paid a bunch of money. 70% of their income is coming from that storage. So if they reduce that, then that reduces their income. But we believe that there can be some give and take between these two companies, and that's really what we're hoping for.
Neither company could be reached for comment by airtime. TU eventually wants to see the study expand beyond brown trout to rainbow and brook trout as well. For now, the fish must be tagged, and the stories of their lives must be told through little radio blips up and down the Deerfield. It has attracted enthusiasts from across the region to come out and volunteer their time. TU chapter president Mike Vito.
These are people from over. Some people want to just come out and do it a couple of times from the Boston area. This has really captured a lot of people's imagination. This is where fly fishing is really where science meets the sport. It's all about conservation for us, because we know that, and you know, we love fishing the way we do, and we can make it better.
Reporting from the WAMC News Berkshire Bureau at the Beacon Cinema, I'm Josh Landes.
Of course, this past July marked the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing on the moon. A participant in the planning and decision-making was Don Wise, an emeritus professor of geosciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. An expert on how the moon was formed, Wise in 1969 was deputy director and chief scientist on the manned Apollo landing team at NASA. One of his key responsibilities was to give advice to the astronauts about safe landing spots on the moon. WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief Paul Tuthill interviewed Wise.
I sat on NASA advisory committees through the middle 1960s, and then I was teaching at Franklin and Marshall College. And then as a result of that, as the time came for the lunar landing, there was this little group that was the link between the engineering and science half of NASA called MAL, Manned Apollo Landing, and they needed a deputy director and chief scientist, so I took that job. And as a result, I had a ringside seat to much of what happened during the those years.
Okay, so what did happen? You were helpful, as I understand it, in trying to identify precise locations on the moon where we could land. Is that right?
This selection process had been going on for 3 or 4 years, and I had been part of it. That it had to be on the near side for communications. It had to be in low latitudes because of just orbital constraints. It had to be the smoothest, most bland area you could find, preferably near the lunar center. And so we selected. We had 3 or 4 sites that we examined, and then we had the final lunar orbiter, the fifth of the lunar orbiter missions. We just photographed the Dickens out of that site and zeroed in on this as the smoothest, flattest, easiest place on the near side we could land. The day that they cracked the hatch and went down on the lunar surface, there were about a half dozen of us who were supposed to lay out what the astronauts were to do when they did the first field trip on another planetary surface. And the first thing you do is you have to say, where are we, before you start a field trip. And as a result of the imagery, we knew that they were in an area that was maybe 3 miles by 15 miles, something like that, an elliptical area. And they could have been at any one of 6 spots. And the worst thing about it was what they described looking out the window was they weren't at any of them. We had 5 hours between the landing and when they were going to crack the hatch and go down, Armstrong go down. And what do you do? What they're describing on the surface is that they're on the flank of a certain kind of crater, of which there's only one in the landing area. And from the shadows, we can tell where they are on that, the flank of that. And from that, we laid out what they were going to do. And the engineer says, no, no, we says, go for it. And when they cracked the hatch, that's where they were.
Were you surprised that they landed on the first try?
I just have my field notebook. I just dug it out the other day. And this is what I wrote that day. July 16th, 1969. Some thoughts just before launch, namely 20 minutes beforehand. The air here in the Apollo office is one of calm expectation. We can do nothing about it now. Underneath the calm, there's the nagging uneasiness, knowledge that failure here would have profound consequences on the national image, mood, future, coupled with knowing too many little things which have gone wrong in past missions. We saw all sorts of things. This was edge of your fingernails. The fact that this is probably the most significant milestone of science in this century is floating in the air. Perhaps the most amazing thing to me is the matter-of-fact air of the room. Intense interest, not the interesting that one might expect, just calm relaxation. The atmosphere seems superficially like a room full of people watching a rather routine baseball game. Underneath, understated, we're excited as all hell. That was written in the few moments when they're just after they landed. So,
what did you learn from the Apollo missions to the moon? And are you disappointed that we haven't gone back there since the Apollo program ended in the 1970s?
Well, you have to recognize that Kennedy set as our goal the origin of the moon, that we're going to understand the origin of the moon. And the Apollo samples gave us half of that. And what the samples proved unquestionably is that the moon is a child of the Earth's mantle. There are about a half dozen different isotopic decay systems, all of which give you chemical identity with the Earth's sample, some of them at parts per million. There's no question that the moon is a child of the Earth's mantle. That's half of the story. The other half is there have been 50 years now that the attempt attempts have been made to make the giant impact model fit with the composition, and to date there has not been a single computer simulation that replicates the Apollo samples. We still do not have a credible mechanisms for the origin of the moon.
All right, those were some of our favorite stories of 2019. Can't wait to see what 2020 holds. Thanks for being with us as we got this podcast off the ground this year. And remember to stay subscribed for the latest from the Northeast. Happy New Year. Till next time, I'm Ian Pickus.